The following presentation was recorded at the 1997 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
How many of you will be first-year teachers this year? Raise them high so I can see. All right, is anybody here who has taught 20 years? 10? 5? It looks to me like the preponderance is beginning teachers. Well, my first experience goes back over 30 years ago, so it's. But I remember it very well. I remember the first day of school. I remember I prepared lessons and prepared lessons and prepared lessons and taught all of them in about the first half hour. So, if that happens to you, don't feel bad. I think it was Billy Graham that said that the first messages he preached, somebody thought he could preach, and so they put him on a program down in Florida for three messages. And he prepared three 45-minute messages, and he had the same experience. He said he preached all three of them in the first 20 minutes, and then he tried to decide what he was going to do the rest of the time. So, but you do get long-winded after a while. That problem does sort of remedy itself. Well, I'm glad to be with you here tonight, and I'm glad to discuss the subject of critical reading because it is a very important subject, and we'll get into that in just a moment. But I have a question I'd like to ask you before I start. How many of you know how to read? Very well. Put your hands up a little higher. How many know how to read? Well, you're all way ahead of one of the greatest German poets and dramatists by the name of Johann Wolfgang Goethe, who had this to say: I have been learning to read for the past 50 years, but have not yet succeeded. So it was sort of a trick question. The art of reading, and it is an art, is a very challenging art. Because at its best, language is imperfect. And the writer never can completely convey what he meant to say. And you never can completely understand what he meant to say. And so there it is. There's a tremendous inefficiency involved in reading. I want to choose as a theme verse tonight for critical reading the verse from 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 21, where God invites us to critical thinking. And the first thing I want to mention tonight is really this subject, critical reading, is a misnomer. There is only one skill in reading. Now, what do we have here? Does this work? I'm assuming that today you've covered the first, I'd sooner have a black one here. You probably covered the first one rather thoroughly, decoding. That's phonetics, phonics, what we call the grunt and groan process of learning this whole process. And then the next is comprehending. And those are the two that you probably studied today, how to teach that. And this one tonight is evaluating. And I'd like to say right off that there's nothing particularly unique about these two in reading class. This is really only the only aspect of the teaching of reading, because once the child can read the words, these two are really what he does with those words. And if he has trouble comprehending words or sentences and ideas out of his reading book, he doesn't just have a reading problem. He would have the same problem if you said those things to him. He's having trouble thinking. So these are actually thinking skills. These are not reading skills. Properly, reading is only learning to say the words off the page. That's all reading is. Now, we teach the rest in reading class. We call it reading. But actually, you'll be working on those not just in reading class. You'll be working on those in all the other subjects, the comprehending and the evaluating, the critical thinking. You'll be doing it on the playground. You'll be doing it in conversation with them. It's a process that has to be developed outside of the reading class as well as in the reading class. So we're not just talking about critical reading. We're actually talking about critical thinking. And we'll get into that in just a moment. But here's this verse. It says, prove all things. So we have a command tonight to test and evaluate everything that we hear spoken, everything we read. And it says, hold fast that which is good and let the rest go. Abstain from all appearance of evil. And then the tremendous promise in verse 23, and the very God of peace, and that word peace is the Old Testament idea of shalom, which means well-being, prosperity, success, holistic living, words you want to put in here that means well-being in the highest sense of the word. The God of peace sanctify, set you apart, and put you all in one piece. And I pray that your whole spirit, soul, and body be preserved blameless unto the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. And so tonight, it's pretty crucial that you learn to think critically and that you teach your children to, because it's the only way they will ever come to reality. It's the only way they'll ever come to peace, to holistic well-being, if I may use that term. Now, I have a few things to say about comprehension, and I knew Brother Jonas would cover this, and if I say the same thing he said, then I do believe in the law of repetition. I'll just give you the two general principles of teaching, and I can give them to you in 2 minutes, and if you do these two things, you'll be a good teacher the rest of your life. The one is repetition. There are only two principles of teaching, and I know Brother Ed teaches courses, and I guarantee you that you could take and put one of these on top of one page and one on the top of another page, and everything he says would come under these. First one is repetition. You must say things often enough that people remember what you said. But then you'll bore them to tears if you don't have the second one. And that's variety. And so there's where you tell the stories and you give interesting facts and you give them analogies and you give them illustrations and you draw diagrams on the board. And you say the same thing over and over again in as many different ways as you possibly can from as many different angles. But it's repetition and variety. That's what it is. So if I repeat something, it's just simply a law of teaching. I'd like to just go down over a couple things. The reason I'm doing this is because all of this is presupposed in critical thinking and critical reading. If a child does not have some tools here, he's not going to do very well going to the next level of evaluating. The first one that I would emphasize is word meaning. Now that sounds very, very mundane, but I want to talk about it just a little bit. We think with words. That is the unique capacity of the human being. I don't think that animals think with words. The parrots might have a few words, and the chimpanzees maybe can be taught a few, but I don't know what their logical processes are like, but I don't think they're thinking in words, but you do. You are actually thinking in sentences when you think. All right? You cannot think precisely if you do not have precise words to think with. You just can't do it. And one of the reasons why people think so sloppily is because they do not have good words to think with. Do all you can to develop your own vocabulary. It is the foundation of all thinking and the vocabulary of your students. I had the good fortune of following a teacher in my first year of teaching who taught school for 40 years and who taught all 8th grade. She taught in a one-room school, then she taught in a two-room school, and she had 40 years of experience in a variety of teaching situations. And I walked into this room and opened up the file drawers and the boxes of stuff that she had. And the unique thing that I found in that room was everywhere I turned, in every subject, she had vocabulary lists, she had vocabulary booklets, she had dictionary studies. Through the social studies book, the social studies book did not have the words in italics that were the key words, but she had them all marked. She had worksheets made up for them to learn those words. She had tests made up, and I learned from her a basic concept of critical thinking and comprehension and how to teach it just by learning that simple thing. Because she said to me, I went to visit her shortly after I started teaching, and I said, tell me something that you think is some things that you think are very important for me to learn. And right away she talked about vocabulary. And she said, if a child can define and explain and articulate the meanings of the key words of any subject, he understands the subject. So the biggest step that you will ever take with your students toward understanding is to make sure they master the basic terms of the science, the social studies, whatever it is you're studying. You can do that however you want to do it, but that is basic. That would be my first approach to any subject, is to isolate all of the terms that seem to be the key terms upon which all the meanings are going to hinge that we're going to talk about, and I'd actually put those in a list, and I'd try to find a variety of ways to drill those, and I would drill them and drill them, and I did that. And I would say if I had any success in my first year of teaching, it was because I did that, just that. That is a basic principle of teaching. Let me just show you what I mean. Now, those of you who know me know I have been a lifelong lover of words. In fact, it resulted finally for me in an occupation. I spend all my time editing medical text, and I wrestle over words and their meanings, and whether the right words are there, and whether the author has said what he wants to say. You see, if you have the word run, that's not a very good word. If you have to use the word run, then use the word run. But that's not going to very precisely communicate anything to anybody. And if you use that word in your thinking to recapitulate some incident and try to do some thinking about it, you're not going to have a very precise idea. Here are some other words. Don't say run. Did he sprint? Did he trot? Did he scurry? Did he dash? Perhaps he scampered. Do you see what I'm saying? The more precisely you can use words, the more precisely you will think about any subject. And I really want to emphasize that. Do all you can to expand and enrich and refine the vocabulary of your children that you're teaching. What about this word? He cut his finger. Did he slice it? I like that word. Don't you just feel Did he hack it? I remember one time I had a butcher knife. I was cutting a piece of cardboard. While I was cutting with a butcher knife, I'll never know. And I went whack, whack. And I can show you if you come up here afterward where there's two whacks. And it would be a very pitiful explanation of what happened that evening if I told you I cut my finger. In fact, I didn't hack it. I chopped it. So, you know, get the precise word. You know, words, I don't want to spend all evening talking about comprehension, but this is so important.
Well, here's another one. Thin. The person was thin. Were they skinny? Were they slender? You see what's happening here? How many would like to be called slender? Raise your hand. How many would like to be called skinny? See what I'm talking about? And in fact, the only difference between a poet and you and me, perchance, is that the poet knows the value of all of those words. And he won't ever use skinny when he means slender. And he will never say that somebody is stocky if he really meant that they were obese. You follow me? The poet, because words not only have, and now we're in a different subject, words not only have meaning, they have connotations, they have feelings, they have precise experiences that they communicate to you. I mean, you've sliced yourself. You know what that feels like. When somebody says slice, you just cringe because you know what that experience is like. And so comprehension is I would say, the most important ingredient of understanding is a good grasp of words. I would really like to emphasize that. And that's not that hard to do. You don't have to make up an awful lot of worksheets to keep working on this. All right? So word meaning. Drill vocabulary in every subject. The next thing that you should work on in comprehension is you should work on analogies, comparisons, relationships of words. Words that are alike, that compare similar ideas. Grass is to alfalfa as tree is to, you know, get the right relationships. You know, how are words, you know, how are ideas related? In fact, that particular skill, I was told years ago by a psychologist, maybe it was at Chippensburg University, that ability to say tree is to leaf, now we're going from the larger to the smaller, as stalk is to grain, perchance, to get those right analogies, the larger and the smaller, the first and the last, and be able to take, you know, comparison from this word, this set of words, over to this set of words. In fact, if you look at an IQ test, I haven't looked at one for a while, I think that's what you're going to find a lot of. Because I was told that the most significant indication of a person's intelligence is his ability to compare things. All right, so that's another, maybe we went over that today. Inferring, reading between the lines. That's another one. She loved trees and flowers, and after work she was found sitting in the park, office, automobile, church. Now, that's one of the problems I have with many of the workbooks, and that's one of the things I think that the individualized instruction programs have had difficulty doing, and that is because the stuff has to be corrected with keys and there has to be a right answer. Much of the reading, much of the thinking doesn't go much beyond picking out words. You know, up here's a word, put it down here, or an idea and put it down here. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about thinking. All right? Figures of speech. We're still talking really about relationships and analogies. He had a heart of gold. Or he got himself in a pickle. You can imagine what foreigners do with these. All right. And then sequence and main ideas. You know, what are the main ideas? What are the most important things? And what are the things that come to the support of those ideas? Okay, so I just give you those quickly again. But vocabulary is the main one. Vocabulary, analogies, inferring, figures of speech, and outlining. Now let's talk about critical thinking. We're getting now to the next one. Critical thinking. This has to do with evaluating propositions. It has to do with looking at what somebody has said, and from your own experience and your own knowledge, evaluating whether that statement is a true statement. All right? Is it true or is it false? Is it fact or is it opinion? And we're going to be talking about a little bit how we go about doing that. I'm going to give you a little quiz. I will give you a true-false quiz. Here are some propositions. Is there something to clean this with? I made it dirty. Brother Milo. Okay, I think I have room to give you the quiz on the bottom. Can you see it? Let's put it up so you can see it. Decide if each statement is true or false. I can't see that with my glasses. Is it clear? Can you in the back see it? Yeah. Fine. Just give you a couple minutes, a five-question true-false test. True or false? Give me a second here to get this moisture off. Okay. Now, let me look at it. While they're looking at that. Oh, yeah.
Just pass these down the rows and
how'd you make out?
Salvation. depends on, we're going to introduce a word here just real quickly. We're going to have to understand what do we mean by salvation. What propositional statement are we going to make to describe this word? Another problem word in the sentence. Faith. All right, number two. The essential meaning of salvation is going to happen when I die. How many put true for that? How many put false? All right. I'm going to have to agree with the people who said false. Because the Bible talks about us being saved from sin and death. And the primary meaning is salvation. Salvation. The word literally means salvation. But see, we have to immediately talk about propositions. What do we mean by these terms? Number three, to be saved, a person needs only to believe in Jesus. True? False? You people give the fundamentals a nightmare. You must have been in Brother Bodley's class. What's the problem in this sentence? We're going to have to talk about propositions before we can even analyze it.
Accepting the Savior.
Okay.
Bible has more than one meaning for believe.
Believe.
Yes.
I mean, there, we have a can of worms immediately. We're going to have to come to terms with that word before we even decide whether that's... actually, these statements are probably all true, except a couple here at the end. Maybe the direct... Well, I'm giving this out of the way. Number four. Christianity is basically a matter of obeying the word of God. True? False? What's the problem? Don't you even believe and obey the word of God? What's this? Yes? I'm going to want to define the word of God. Now, if you're going to define the word of God as the Bible, I'm going to have a tremendous problem. Because now we just have plain down legalism. But if you mean by the word of God in the beginning was the word, Christ, and the Bible is a means to knowing him, and you're going to obey him, now the statement is true. You could never make a truer statement. All right, number five. The unique theme of Anabaptism was sola scriptura, the scriptures alone. True? False? Well, you team were all good Anabaptists. That was the slogan of the Reformers. That's not what made the Anabaptists unique. That one's false. That's the only one on there that is clearly false. All right, so we have to talk... We have to talk about assumptions. That's what we have to talk about. So take the sheet that I gave you here, this little handout that says factors for critical reading. All right, the problem is we have biases. And a bias is a favor or opposition to a subject based on a personal feeling. Let's answer a couple of these. Which of these have biases and which of them do not? Now, if you have something that is without a bias, you can say without any qualification it is absolutely a factual statement. There's no personal feeling or bias or opinion involved in the statement. Number one, the new pollution laws are sure to make for a cleaner, more attractive community. Factual or biased?
Biased.
Okay, we have a lot of assumptions being made here. What do we mean by a cleaner community? What do we mean by a more attractive community? Can it be proven that these laws will do that? Number two, new pollution laws will go into effect next month. Government leaders are watching to see the impact of the new laws. Factual or biased? There's no opinion in that. That's just a statement of what's going to happen. Number three, the new pollution laws are going to be an expensive burden to many small businesses in our community. Biased or factual?
Biased.
Okay, we have the word expensive. What do we mean by expensive? What do we mean by small businesses? And so on. Okay? So now we come to the term assumptions, a statement accepted to be true without being proved to be true. Identify the assumption in this sentence. The new ambulance, too expensive for a town of 10,000, has been a source of argument in the town council. What part of this statement is an assumption? Okay, too expensive for a town of 10,000. All right. So the first thing we have to do in dealing with this whole matter of critical reading is to decide whether the proposition... I'm not going to ask you to write all this, or I see we're going to be out of time. Just put true or false, T or F, down along the margin, and actually you're supposed to substantiate it with facts from the story. You don't have to write those out, but you can be thinking what your reason was for putting true or false. This is a workshop, and I wanted you to get a little bit of experience with this. This is the type of thing you should have your students do a lot of. Prove propositions.
You're supposed to substantiate your answer of true or false by something from the story.
Based only on the story.
Based only on the story. What you see in the story. This would be the first step to critical thinking. Actually taking the facts that you have and seeing if the proposition is true or false.
All right, you've had a chance to read the story and you've gotten your feet wet. Let's do it together. Number one, the story must be fictional rather than true. How many believed that was a true statement? How many believed it was a false statement?
Okay. Does anybody want to tell me why you think that's a false statement?
Second paragraph said one day last summer, specific time.
Okay. It gives a specific time. Anybody else have another comment?
First person.
It's written in the first person. Now, this doesn't always make things true, but you can analyze this very carefully, and I don't think you'll find anything in the story that would prevent this from being a true story. There's nothing in here that would give you a clue that it's not true. So we'll just assume that we'll say that that proposition is a fact. Number two, the presence of the cat will remind Aunt Martha of a bad bargain. True or false? How many say true? How many say false? Can you prove it? What was that? She's not permitted any pets in her apartment, so there won't be any pet there. That's a false statement. Okay? Now, these kinds of exercises are fun. In the first place, the story is very interesting. and, you know, this is the enjoyable part of teaching reading. This is the part I always enjoy, discussing these kinds of things with the children. Number three. The placement of the saucer had to be determined carefully by the shopkeeper. True or false? All right, I see one hand for how many said true. All right, I won't ask for the wrong answers. It's true, okay? I don't want to embarrass anybody. Okay, why was that a true statement? Okay. She wanted everybody to see that saucer. And it had to be placed where everybody would see it. Okay? Number four. Aunt Martha underestimated the shopkeeper's knowledge of bargain hunters. The answer is true. Can somebody prove it? Okay, she told him it wasn't worth a quarter. Okay. Yes? Okay. She got trapped. I mean, the obvious thing is she got trapped. She thought she was pulling one on the lady, and the lady was pulling one on her. Number five, the shopkeeper will return Aunt Martha's money. That obviously is false. She had sold over 100 cats, and none of those people got their money back. A man? Yes. Yes, it was a man. Sorry. That's a fact. All right. Number six. The shopkeeper was surprised when my aunt offered to buy the cat. That is false. That's what she expected. It's what it was all about. The ruse had worked many times. What did you say, Ruth? I'm sorry. I've had this in my head. It's a woman. ever since I did it. You have to pardon me. All right, number seven. Aunt Martha bargained directly for what she wanted to buy. That is false. She offered to buy the cat, not the saucer. But it was the saucer she wanted. All right? Number eight, the location of the shop is important in this story. That is true. It's located near the turnpike. And that brings many bargain hunters. Number nine, the author approved of bargain hunters who outwitted shopkeepers. Now you're getting into values. Analyzing this woman's philosophy of life. The author approved of bargain hunters who outwitted shopkeepers. False. She had a bias. She was against people like Aunt Martha. She didn't like those kind of people who tried to cheat people. She liked to see them get their comeuppance. All right, number 10. Both Aunt Martha and the shopkeeper showed that they believed in the old proverb, the end justifies the means. Yes, they both believed that. They both were dishonest.
to trick the other person. And so they must have believed that the end justifies doing something wrong. I mean, if the end is what they want, then it's okay to do whatever you do to get the end.
Well, that's critical reading. That, yes?
I agree with you with number 9, but my students say you haven't proven it from the article.
I agree with that. The author approved of bargain hunters who outwitted shopkeepers.
Wait a minute. That's false. Did I say true?
It's false.
It's false. Well, she allowed the shopkeeper. In other words, the last part of the story is that the bargain hunter lost. The shopkeeper won. She didn't approve of bargain hunters who outwit people. They lose. Okay, yes. The niece or the nephew. Well, but she's telling the story, or he is. Okay. Very well. All right. Now we want our children. We want our children to be very, very concerned about proving that what they read is either fact or opinion, because it's reality that we want them to live in. And you say, well, we live in a world that's so confusing, and those kind of questions you had here on the board, how can anyone know? Well, Jesus assumed that people could know. He constantly, through the New Testament, he talks about knowing, and you shall know. And John uses this term over and over, and the term knowledge. I mean, we can, if we think critically. And Jesus was constantly working at this. You know, to the assumption that God rested on the seventh day and we must keep a Sabbath very, very strictly. What did Jesus say? You have a false assumption. You assume that on the seventh day of creation, God sat down and worked and he's still sitting there. Well, I just came from where he is and he's working on the Sabbath. Your assumption is wrong. The baptism of John. Was it from heaven or was it from men? You better get your assumption right. And once you've stated your assumption, then you can proceed into reality. Which is easier to say? Thy sins be forgiven thee, or rise, take up thy bed and walk. And once we get that assumption straight, then we'll make some progress. By the way, which is easier to say? Thy sins be forgiven thee, or rise, take up thy bed and walk. He has some very interesting questions. It's easier to say, thy sins be forgiven thee. Why? Who would know? But so that you may know that I have power to forgive sins, I'll do the one you think can't be done. Rise, take up your bed and walk. Now what are you going to say about the easy way? And he was constantly forcing people to think about their assumptions. Is it based on fact? Is it based on reality? Or isn't it? Because if we don't have reality, if the person who's writing or speaking, this is what you're going to get. You're going to get propaganda. Would you look at what propaganda is? It's the spreading of information or ideas to persuade people to be for or against something. It doesn't necessarily have to be false. It can be true. It can be truth distorted, or it can be false. I didn't quite know what to do with this subject, whether I should address it to you being critical readers or whether I should address it to teaching children to be critical readers. I wasn't told what it was to be, so it's a little bit of both. All right. So these are some things you can teach children to look for, and I'm going to give you one that will have some of this in it in the next lesson, the next little thing we're going to do. All right, the first one is the bandwagon kind of propaganda. Everyone is doing it. Micaiah, 400 prophets came in here before Ahab, and every one of them said, you go up to Ramoth-Gilead, and God's going to give you the victory. Now go in there and speak what is good. Have you ever been in a situation like that? That's propaganda.
And people write, give you the impression that, well, this is what everybody's thinking. This is what our Anabaptist forefathers all did. Oh. Well, if that's true, I might be impressed, but I want to check that proposition. Did they all do that? And did they all think that?
And was it right?
But for the purpose of this, is it even true that that's what they all thought? You know, and people get on the bandwagon. It can be premillennialism. It can be amillennialism. It can be motive baptism. It can be conspiracy theories. It can be alternate medicine. It can be water smelling. It can be... And people get on a bandwagon. Incidentally, we drilled a well at our house, and I haven't made up my mind about water smelling. I'm not going to make a statement it's of the devil. I think that's a rather strong statement to make. I'm not going to say it isn't. I just want to know, what's the truth about it? Just on its own merits. So when we drilled a well here about 3 years ago, the man brought his well drilling rig there and he backed up and he said, "Now, do you want the peach stick or don't you?" And I said, "Well, I don't want the peach stick, but I said, I want to ask you a question. How long have you been drilling wells?" And he said, 25 years. I said, "You're the man I want to talk to. I want to ask you a question nobody wants to answer for me. You've done it with the peach stick and without. Tell me, which one has the highest incidence of success?" "Neither." He didn't even hesitate. So I don't have to decide if it's of the devil. It's worthless. And that's, you know, why go any further than that? Now you have my opinion. I think it's based on fact. Now I could tell you a couple more stories too. I'll tell you one. We lived on a farm that had the Greencastle Reservoir on it. And the Greencastle area never had enough water. They couldn't attract any industry, so they decided they were going to drill some wells and pump water into this reservoir and get more water for the town. But they needed a big well. I mean, one like that hit a lake underground or something. So they called three fellas in. They didn't tell any of the three that they'd called the others. So the first fellow came with his peach stick, and he walked over to this spot and said, "Oh my, there are two streams cross there, and you'll have all kinds of water. That's so many feet." Fine. They dismissed him, called in the other guy who didn't know that one had been there. He went over to another place, said the same thing. And they brought him over, and they said, "What about over here?" "Nothing. It's over there." They called in the third fellow. He went down on the other side of the reservoir, where it was very unhandy, up along the side of the hill. Said the same thing. They said, "My, it'd be awful to get a well drilling rig up the side of this hill. What about over here?" "Nothing." "What about over here?" "Nothing." "Down there's where it is." So they called in the well driller. He drilled the first one. He got 10 gallons a minute at 300 feet. Called in he moved over there and went down 100 feet and got a few gallons a minute. And I said to him, I said, "Look, isn't there a scientific way to discover water?" "Oh, yes." "What is it?" "Drill down and find out." So, you know, we're talking about the bandwagon, all right? But people get on these bandwagons, and, you know, it becomes a fad, and everybody in the community is all excited, and people aren't thinking. They're not asking those kinds of questions to those kind of people. And so that's propaganda. All right, the second one is the testimonial. You'll see this, and you teach your children to look for them. A famous individual recommends something or disagrees about its worth. Menno Simon said, "Ooh, he did." You know what he said? He said some things that I don't agree with. Now, it's all right. Menno Simon said many things, but people want to do this. They quote people for authority, and that's good. I mean, if somebody says Menno Simon to me, I'm going to give it some serious consideration because he said it, but that's not going to be the final determiner of whether it's fact. I'm going to have to go look to see if Menno Simon was right. The Pharisees tried it. They said, "Have any of the rulers of the Pharisees believed on Jesus? You bunch out here? Did you hear of any of the Pharisees who believed? Well, then there must be something wrong, because you're believing something that these very important people do not believe. All right, number three is transfer. Associate the idea or the product with someone the reader feels positive about, so the feeling will transfer. Abraham is our father. Oh. You say you're the son of God. Well, we are the sons of Abraham. We're associated with him. Now, you can transfer everything that you know about him to us, because we are his descendants. Number four, repetition. The writer repeats names, words, or phrases to make the hearer think about them. He's a pietist. That's pietism. That's a pietistic idea. How many are hearing that word over and over and over again? You know what's happening? That's propaganda. They want you to believe, with enough repetitions of pietists, as something very bad, that you wouldn't ever want to be called such a thing. I suspect that most of the people who are throwing this word around and repeating it over and over again and driving it slowly but surely into the psyche of all of our conservative people as something they wouldn't ever want to be, don't know an awful lot about the pietists. In fact, I asked them, are you talking about Augustus Frank? And I see the blank look in their eyes. Or are you talking about Count von Sinzendorf? Another blank look. What about David Zeisberger, who started the first school and church in Ohio and won two whole tribes to Christ and to non-resistance, so that when the Continental Army came through and found these non-resistant Christians and they were very angry at the Indians, they slaughtered both tribes. Are you talking about David Zeisberger? Well, no, they didn't know about him. But pietism is something very bad. So you repeat it often enough till people are scared of the word. Number five, some of these are related. Emotional words. Words that arouse rather than inform. He's a liberal. By the way, did you ever do a word study of the book liberal in the Bible? Did anybody ever do that? I should let you do it without telling, but I can't keep you from telling. It has a positive meaning every time. Biblically, it's a very good word. It means generous, kind, tolerant, sharing, loving, which we all know the liberals are, of course. Traitor, wimp, naive, ignorant. I mean, these are emotional words. And when people start throwing them around, what I'm saying about all of these is, when you see one of these, a red flag should go up, and you should teach your children that, wait a minute, this is starting to hit where you shouldn't hit. Maybe you better check. Repetition. I forgot this one. How many of you have read the Julius Caesar by Shakespeare? This is my favorite, where Mark Antony gives the funeral address for Caesar. What does he keep repeating? Over and over and over again, until he drives it into their thinking and they react to it. Is that going to remember?
Caesar was ambitious. I've got St. Brutus and his follower for honorable
death. Yeah, he said he was ambitious, but then he would say, but these are honorable. They say he's ambitious. And they must be right, because they're honorable men. And they say this about Caesar, but they're honorable men. And they say this about Caesar, but of course they're honorable men. And after the crowd says, honorable men, they are traitors.
I like that one. All right. Repetition, see? You get suspicious. See, the crowd got suspicious. They did the right thing with propaganda. They got suspicious to hear that. They thought, no, wait, he's up to something by repeating that over and over again. Name calling. Belittling names instead of facts.
He's a Calvinist. He's a second work of grace holiness man. He's a charismatic. He believes in eternal security. Those are nasty names that people get labeled with by people who want to go beyond the facts and win you to their cause without going to the work of presenting the information. Number 7, faulty cause and effect. They say this causes this, but there's no relationship. I was standing down by the barn where I grew up there at Greencastle one day, and in came a neighbor of mine on a snowmobile, and he was a pastor of the local Church of the Brethren. Very good friend of ours, plain man, taught in a public school, and we were good friends. And we got to talking about the apostasy in the Mennonite church, and he said, "You know, I know exactly where it started." Now I want to hear this. I mean, anybody who can put his finger on exactly where it started. And he said, "It started when such and such a church allowed 4 men to sing together and give special programs in the Mennonite church. That's where the apostasy started." It was clear to him, there's no doubt in his mind, that if they wouldn't have done that, we'd be in fine shape. Then we had another group who came along and said, "The problem is the Mennonite colleges. It's higher education." Well, now, I was a teenager sitting there listening to all of this, and then I reflected. I grew up in a church that went really off the wrong end of things, and I was the only college graduate in the church, and we never had had special singing. But see, people, you know, they try to make you believe this. They don't want this. And so they say, "That's what did it." And when somebody talks about cause and effect, my ears go up because I want to know what they're talking about. And often it's wrong because they're trying to push a point. George R. Brunk said, "If you have musical instruments in your homes, the next generation will have them in the church." Well, we didn't get one yet in our church, but we've had them in our homes for several generations. Those kinds of statements are made. I shouldn't have said who said that. That came out before I realized it. Number 8, compare and contrast. They compare similar things to convince someone that one is better than the other. And you've got to be careful with this. When I heard an advertisement one time that I thought was very curious. It was at a teacher's institute, by the way. This man was trying to prove that his books were better than others, and he was using this as an analogy. He said, "Now, some companies make razors that have electric razors that have holes in the head. And then there's another company that says, 'No, that won't do the job as well. You need to have slots in the head, little slots instead of holes.' And then another company comes along and says, 'Our razor has both slots and holes.'" Now, what are you supposed to conclude? That it's better than this one and this one. But I suspect that if I shaved with all 3 of them, I wouldn't be able to tell any difference. All right. That's what happens when children don't think and people do not think critically. Now, I'd like you to pick up one. We're just about out of time here. Here's one where we're going to analyze a little bit what's going on. Ladybug, ladybug. I'm going to read this one out loud since we're running out of time. We'll just do it together. How would you like to be in the ladybug business? Several people in California are. They find it a good way to earn a living and to perform a service for their fellow men at the same time. Ladybugs are happy to eat insect pests, which can destroy fruit and other crops, so farmers are glad to have them around. The more ladybugs they have, the less spraying they must do. Farmers in need of ladybugs can buy them by the pint or by the gallon, depending on the size of their farms. The people who sell them figure there are about 100,000 insects in a gallon, but probably no one ever took the trouble to count them. The ladybugs are harvested in the fall when they begin to hibernate. They swarm in such large numbers that they can be scooped up with a shovel. Then they're packed into special screen cartons and mailed to people who have ordered them. They travel to all parts of the country. The state of Washington thinks so highly of the work of ladybugs that it refuses to part with them. There are laws which forbid anyone to ship them out of the state. So the next time you see a ladybug, instead of greeting it with that old bit about ladybug, ladybug, fly away home, you might say, "Thanks, old girl. Glad to have you around." Number one, let's have some facts from this article, just very quickly.
Ladybugs eat insects.
Ladybugs eat insects, okay? They hibernate, okay? Any more? What? He says he didn't count them. But we'll take that as a statement of fact, okay? You think that's a statement of fact? That one I would say is a little questionable. Okay, another one? What's that? They can't be transported out of Washington. All right, there'll be a question later on that. Actually, all of paragraph 4, which is the first paragraph in the second column in paragraph 5, that's those are factual statements. Okay, number 2. List one statement about ladybugs that could be only an opinion.
Ladybugs are happy to eat insect pests.
How would you ever know? What makes a ladybug happy? All right, another one.
Farmers are glad to have them around.
Did they interview the farmers? Now, maybe they did. I mean, who knows? Okay? Now, that's based on a syllogism that goes a little bit like this. Farmers hate...
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.